From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Friday, the Secretary of the U.S. Army resigned. It was the latest shoe to drop in the wake of the Washington Post's expose 2 weeks ago about the breakdown in outpatient care at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. The article depicted an overloaded system where soldiers with serious injuries must fend for themselves in a nightmarish bureaucracy with substandard facilities. The Post may have made the biggest splash, but in recent weeks, the plight of the wounded also sparked major pieces in Newsweek, The New York Times, The Boston Globe, and NPR, among others. This week, ABC's Bob Woodruff hosted a special on vets with traumatic brain injuries, the signature injury of the roadside bomb, the injury he sustained last year. It's clear why ABC latched onto that story, but why the sudden interest across the media? We put the question to a reporter who's been covering the stories of wounded Iraq war vets probably longer than anybody else. That's Mark Benjamin of the online magazine Salon. He suggests that editors may be more willing to go after these stories, partly because the public is more receptive to bleak news about the war.
To give you an example, I wrote my first story about this issue in the fall of 2003. It was about Fort Stewart, Georgia, and the headline was something like sick and injured soldiers held in squalor, and they couldn't get doctor's appointments, and they weren't being fairly compensated. At that time, I received hundreds of really vicious emails, you know, where I was called a communist and a traitor and I was a liar and so on and so forth. This is something that Congress held hearings about, and the Army publicly said, yes, we've got a problem and we're going to fix it. My guess is that's not the reaction that the Washington Post is getting from its Sears and Walter Reed, and it's not the reaction that I get from doing the same kind of stories now.
Now, there is another reason that we may not have seen, you know, tons of coverage on the subject until now, and that is that the Pentagon has really done its best to manage or even divert what coverage there has been of the wounded. Can you describe what happens if, you know, I, as a reporter, decide to pursue this story and, you know, and call public affairs at the Pentagon and say, I'm interested in outpatient care at Walter Reed or any other military facility? What happens next?
What happens is that reporter is escorted onto the facility. They are brought up to Ward 57, which is the ward where they have amputees, which is an amazing place and does an excellent job. Those reporters are introduced to pre-screened and pre-selected soldiers, and the reporters are given a very limited, very happy news story, which may be true for a small number of soldiers or even maybe a significant number of amputees, but ends up giving the public a very skewed perception of what is happening to the lion's share of people coming back from this war. The military medical system cannot seem to get its arms around wounds that you can't see. In other words, you know, if you're missing a leg, they're going to take care of you. If you have traumatic brain injury, particularly a closed head traumatic brain injury, you can't see anything there. Or you have post-traumatic stress disorder, you're extremely disturbed, you're suicidal, you're homicidal, but there's no physical thing that the medical staff can look at. For some reason, those people, as far as I can tell, get the worst of the lot and are really languishing. And that's a big story that's been overlooked.
Now, I noticed that in the wake of the Post's coverage that the military's response has been, among other things, to clamp down on the patients in the notorious Building 18 at Walter Reed, where the mold was on the walls and rat droppings were everywhere and so forth. The soldiers, according to a report in the newspaper, the Army Times, have to be ready for inspection at 7 o'clock in the morning. Everything's spick and span, and they're forbidden to speak to the media.
I don't know whether that's true, but it wouldn't surprise me one bit. When I first wrote my story back in 2003 at Fort Stewart, Georgia, a very similar thing happened. The day after I wrote that the, you know, troops were being held in squalor and not given proper medical care, the entire, you know, the battalion is stood up in the middle of a field and told to shut up, essentially, and threatened.
And further, in terms of managing the story, I noticed that Big Brass stood up and said, yes, it's, you know, deplorable. There are mice droppings and mold on the walls. Focusing on the aspects of this story that are easily cleaned up, but focusing away from the underlying bureaucracy, the neglect, and maybe even worse, an actual financial conflict of interest on the part of the Pentagon. Can you tell me about it?
What is happening in this story is that the Army is doing two things simultaneously, and they're working at cross purposes. On the one hand, the Army is trying to give these people outpatient therapy, whether that's somebody with, you know, trying to learn to use their prosthetic leg, or somebody getting treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, in other words, from a counselor. At the same time, the Army is trying to decide how much the military is going to pay those soldiers in benefits for the rest of their lives. So you've essentially got a conflict of interest in the Army. They can either pay these guys benefits for the next 50 years, and if they do that, they're going to take money away from more bullets and bombs.
In the wake of the Walter Reed scandal, do you think that overall the press's attention is still being diverted to deplorable physical conditions and still not focused on the underlying structural problems?
I think that reporters have figured out that mice and mold in a building off, you know, the campus of Walter Reed, while very disturbing, is not really what the story is about. What I think reporters are going to start figuring out, or what I hope they're going to start figuring out, is that this is very widespread. It's not just at Walter Reed. It's at Fort Stewart. It's at Fort Carson. It's at Fort Benning. And it's a systemic breakdown. And I think that reporters will start to figure that out. To a certain extent, though, I think there are a lot of reporters that are just sort of trying to figure out exactly what they're dealing with.
Okay, Mark. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Benjamin is a national correspondent for Salon.com. You can link to his ongoing coverage of the war wounded at onthemedia.org.
As Mark Benjamin said, post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, is an injury that hasn't garnered many major headlines, but that's changing. The Department of Veterans Affairs reports treating 73,000 Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans suffering from what they call mental disorders. It's too early to tell what the true number of PTSD sufferers will be. Whatever it is, these veterans will be among the first to receive this diagnosis during wartime. The psychological damage wrought by war is as old as war itself, but it's only since 1980 that the mental health community, the government, soldiers, and the media have adjusted to the new clinical phrase, PTSD. Dr. Matthew Friedman is the executive director of the Veterans Affairs National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
So PTSD is just the most recent term for post-traumatic stress disorder. When was trauma that you couldn't see first recognized?
The first people that really recognized it were poets and writers. There are a number of books suggesting that Achilles suffered from what we would now call PTSD after his best friend and lover, Patrocles, was slain in the Trojan War. Shakespeare's Henry V had what are clearly traumatic nightmares. Shifting to the medical realm, the American Civil War, is when medical folks got into the act. When people were unable to function effectively as soldiers, the medical hypothesis was that something had shifted in the person's physiology that couldn't be seen outwardly, so we had the term soldier's heart. People making the same observations called this nostalgia. The idea behind it was that someone from Vermont Brigade, who found himself fighting the Battle of Vicksburg in Mississippi, was missing his New England home so much that he was incapacitated.
So let's go to World War I, a new war, a new term for this kind of trauma.
It was shell shock, and the presumption was that proximity to the big artillery guns was somehow destroying some of the neural architecture in the brain, so people's nerves were kind of jangled. A lot of theories about the nervous system, which of course was a good repository for speculation because there was no way to test these things.
And then you come to World War II and they chose a more general term. They called it combat fatigue or battle fatigue or combat neurosis.
Well, you see, those terms are not equivalent. The physical explanation being combat fatigue, the body was depleted, exhausted in some way, unable to rise to the occasion. War neurosis came out of a psychoanalytic tradition based strongly on the work of Sigmund Freud. And the Freudian hypothesis was these people really had a neurosis before they were actually put in uniform, but it was the stress of the combat theater that unmasked this.
By the 30s and 40s, you had the rise of American movies and also the depiction of this condition in such films as The Best Years of Our Lives.
Right.
What do you think the impact of that kind of cinematic depiction was?
I think that what it did for the American public was focus attention on the plight of veterans, because I think that what is historically the case following all wars is that the public, in its eagerness to move forward and put the war behind it, neglects, forgets its veterans. I think that until recently, I think there was no real way to understand why these people who were so vital, so strong, so brave, were unable to get on with their lives.
If we jump from the 40s to the 80s and the term PTSD, did the Vietnam War give rise to this term?
The veterans of the Vietnam War and the clinicians, and I'm one of them, who tried to help them with their psychological distress, were clearly a part of the movement that created what we now call PTSD. But we weren't alone. There were other people who'd been working in other domains with other kinds of traumatized groups. There were people who'd been working with concentration camp survivors, prisoners of war. There was something called rape trauma syndrome. When they all came together, they recognized that, yes, the trauma itself had been very different, but the kinds of symptoms, the kinds of clinical demands were very, very similar. And I believe it really did provide an umbrella, if you will, a construct under which all of these different syndromes could be understood.
Now, some historians of PTSD have said that for the medical community and the press and the public, there's been a pattern of hyper-awareness during times of war, and then a kind of oblivion sets in as soon as the immediate problem recedes from view. Is that your observation?
I think that that has generally been the case. I'm not sure it's still the case. The media really discovered PTSD around the mid-80s. They didn't quite get it right, I think, until the 90s. And I think that with that recognition, this kind of cycle that you describe and that I agree with, I think it's gotten to a point where I don't think that people are going to forget PTSD. I don't think they can.
Dr. Friedman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Matthew Friedman is the executive director of the Veteran Administration's National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder.
Coming up, the highs and lows of stock market reporting and why your cell phone isn't as good as it could be.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Tuesday, a banking crisis spawned a free fall in the Chinese stock market, triggering investor fears that caromed around the world. In the U.S., combined with former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan's public comments about a possibly looming recession, the news resulted in a loss of more than 400 points on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the largest such decline since 9/11. It was also the top story everywhere, but should it have been? Economist Dean Baker of the American Prospect believes that media preoccupation with the ups and downs of Wall Street not only distracts us from more significant economic issues, but mistakenly assumes a rising market is good for everybody.
There's a tendency to talk about the stock market like it's the home team, so that when the stock market's up, we should all be out and celebrating. When it's down, this is bad news, we should all be dour and glum. Well, actually, for many, perhaps most of us, the stock market isn't the home team. Most people own little or no stock. 75% of the public has less than $25,000 in the stock market. That includes the 401ks that they may have if they have them. So for them, you know, if the stock market's down, it's not necessarily bad news. It could even be good news.
You're suggesting that when the stock market is up for somebody, that's bad news?
Well, it can be. I mean, the way to think about it is there's sort of three general ways in which you could see the stock market rising. One, it could be rising because profits are projected to be higher, and they're projected to be higher because the economy is projected to grow more rapidly. In that case, we could say that is good. But it may be rising because people anticipate higher profits because wages are going to be lower, or maybe corporate income taxes are going to be lower. That's, again, good if you own a lot of stock, but if you're the person picking up the tax tab because the corporations aren't paying it, you may not be happy. And, of course, if you're the person working for wages and profits are higher because your wages are lower, you're not going to be happy. And the third story is, you know, Alan Greenspan's irrational exuberance story of the late 90s where you had a stock bubble. You know, if you're there riding the bubble and you're a shrewd trader and you can get out on top, good for you. But most people weren't in that boat. And so in that sense, you could say that was bad news for, you know, really most people, I think, that the stock market got completely out of line with the fundamentals in the economy.
But the indices do reflect, don't they, what the markets believe the economy is going to do? Should we not pay attention if worldwide traders are flinching at, for example, Alan Greenspan's remarks or the banking scandal in China?
Well, again, you know, there are grounds for concern in the economy, but I would focus on those rather than the market's reactions because, you know, there's an old line that, you know, the stock market's predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions. I mean, the markets often move in erratic ways for reasons that can't be pinned on any fundamentals. And just to take the most obvious example, going back to 1987, we had this huge crash. You know, I think it was a 20% downturn in the major indices. And you go look at the economic news at that time, you'd be really hard-pressed to find anything that happened, you know, in that immediate period, you know, the few days leading up to the crash. You know, in that case, you could point to economic troubles. You know, there's always clouds on the horizon. But, you know, the reality was the economy continued to grow for almost 3 more years. So there wasn't an imminent recession. There was nothing really bad that you could point to, but yet the markets plummeted.
Clearly, we are, many of us, fixated on the NASDAQ or the Dow or whatever. It shows up on NPR, for example, at the top of, you know, every hour with the news summary. What's behind that?
Well, I think there's two things. One is it's very nice to think that you have a simple number that, you know, could just sort of quantify everything, you know, and a lot of things you can. You know, if I know how many points someone scores in a basketball game, I have a pretty good idea of how good a player they are. So it's convenient. The other thing is there obviously is a bias here. You know, if you look at who often listens to the news and to some extent who reports the news, certainly the people who run the newspapers, the radio stations, the television stations, disproportionately, these are people who are likely to own stock and might own a significant amount of stock. So for them, you know, it is a big deal.
If you had been the boss of journalism on Tuesday, what marching orders would you have issued the troops?
I would give them two orders. First off, keep your distance from the market. You know, report on stock prices like you're reporting about oil prices. You know, oil prices, if they go up and you happen to own an oil well, own shares in ExxonMobil, you're very, very happy. Otherwise, it may not necessarily be very good news for you. The second is that there are real issues about the health of the economy. Alan Greenspan's comments deserve to be taken seriously. If nothing else, he's obviously an astute observer of the economy. There was other economic news, home sales. You know, there were other news that came out that day. So focus on the issues about the underlying economy and separate that from the stock market.
Okay, I think it's pretty clear now that you think the stock market is overcovered or at least not covered with the proper perspective. But what stories in the economy do you think are undercovered? And what should we in the media be paying more attention to?
Well, I'll give you two stories that I think are hugely undercovered. One of them is certainly the trade situation because, you know, people have talked about the budget deficit. The trade deficit is 3 times as large. We get reports on that every month from the Commerce Department. I think that deserves a lot more attention than it gets. The other one is just really the dollars and cents for most people. Most people get the vast majority of their income from their wages. And, you know, the trends in wages, we get wage data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics every month with the employment report. That usually gets some passing mention. But in terms of, you know, how people are doing, the rate of wage growth is far, far more important than what the stock market's doing. Because for most people, that really is their living standard. If wages are growing well, they're doing better. They could look to being wealthier in their future. Hopefully their kids will be better off. That's a good thing for them. If wages are stagnating, as been the case through much of the last 25 years, that's not good news, even if the stock market's going through the roof.
Dean, thank you so much.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on.
Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. His blog about economics reporting is called Beat the Press. It can be found on the American Prospect website.
Today, there are 200 million cell phone subscribers. The wireless industry has grown up in the last decade, so it's a good time to ask, how's it doing? Columbia Law Professor Tim Wu says, not so good. Yes, we have service at competitive prices, but we could have so much more. We don't, says Wu, because the big wireless carriers, Verizon, Singular AT&T, Sprint Nextel, and T-Mobile, have a stranglehold on product design. In a paper he presented to the Federal Trade Commission, Wu details many of the improvements we could enjoy if the wireless carriers let us. For example, we could more easily transfer photos or browse the net or even keep track of how much we talk. We can't because the carriers are engaged in what Wu calls feature crippling.
There's often cases where a phone is technologically capable of doing quite a bit, but carriers, because of their business model, a fear of losing revenue, or a potential fear of losing control, won't let the feature be on the telephone and will force equipment manufacturers not to allow the telephone to do something. That's crippling.
And you give us a couple of examples in your paper. I have to say, when I was reading through it, I got angrier and angrier. So let's go through a couple. The first, call timers on telephones. What are they and why don't we have them?
Well, you know, some of the device manufacturers think it would be handy to have something that keeps track of how much time you've used per month, you know, per day. You can monitor your own usage. Phone carriers have acted to prevent consumers from having their own records of how long they've been speaking on their telephones. It's a little bit like, you know, when you're in the casino in Las Vegas, they don't really want you to know how long you've been there. And so there's been a lot of crippling or disabling of phone timers for the full capabilities they could have.
And why don't they want us to know?
Well, there's, I guess, the possibility you could generate an independent record of your billing, and you could compare that with the bill you're sent, and you could say that, you know, I actually didn't talk this much on my phone. And, you know, why would a carrier want that?
That's why I got so angry. And you also talked about access to Wi-Fi and web browsers, GPS and Bluetooth technology.
Bluetooth was promised to make it easy for phones to communicate with other things, computers, printers. It's really hard, believe it or not, just to get your cell phone to talk to your computer for something as simple as just backing up your address book. So when you, if you lose your phone, you've got a backup. Under a lot of carriers' constructions today, Bluetooth is almost completely crippled. You can't send music back and forth. It's very hard to send photos from your phone to your computer. All again because there's a fear of losing control and there's a fear of crippling some potential business model that revolves around charging you to do something with your phone.
I would assume that a lot of these technological advances are being hatched at the places where they make phones, Motorola, Nokia. Why aren't they putting some pressure on the carriers?
You know, they try, but they're sort of living in a state of fear because they depend on being sold by the carriers. You know, the carriers have an almost complete grip on the retailing of phones in this country. They are responsible for over 90% of the retailing of phones. And so, you know, people actually did talk to me secretly. I'll quote a developer, the carriers have all the power in this area. What they say goes.
Now, you say that in the world of wired phones, the policies of these carriers would be, in some cases, not just outrageous, but possibly illegal. So could you take us back to the era before the mobile phone, when a similar battle was being fought over landlines?
Sure. So in the 1950s, 1960s, the Bell Company would not allow you to hook up anything to their phone network. You know, you had to use a Bell phone and only a Bell phone. There was no such thing as consumers hooking up an answering machine, a Mickey Mouse telephone. This was not allowed. There was a large revolution in the late 60s, along with other revolutions. The outcome of this consumer revolution was something called, technically, the Carter phone rule, but more clearly is a consumer's right to attach anything they want to their phone network, whether it's a strange phone, whether more importantly it's a modem, whether it's an answering machine. And consumers don't have that right in the wireless world. You don't have the same consumer right to attach. It may sound very technical, but that consumer right to attach modems in the 1970s and 80s is what led to the birth of the entire internet in the first place. And I'm suggesting that if consumers have that right to use their mobile service for what they want to use it for, we will see a similar revolution and a similar blossoming that we saw in the internet in the 1990s.
even if you're not technically inclined, you can see the limitations of this lockdown. For instance, if you buy a phone that you really like and you change carriers, your phone is locked up, you have to buy a new phone. You can't take it with you. And you wrote in your paper that it'd be very easy to unlock these phones. They are simply not permitted to. And that leads to a question that I think a lot of consumers have had about Apple's much ballyhooed iPhone. You can't use it unless you subscribe to Singular, an AT&T service, right?
I think that's right. And I think it was a surprise to a lot of people. You know, you think Apple had this great new product and, you know, it turns out it's locked to Singular's network. Now, that may change, and I'm hoping that consumer pressure will lead to a world where you see your phone as something that you own, not the carrier. You own. I mean, you pay for it. And then you can bring it and say, listen, I've got this great phone or this great device, and I want to use it.
Now, back before the Carter phone decision, AT&T was saying, if you don't have a unified system, it just won't work. And that system is AT&T. Now the carriers are saying, you don't need to be re-regulating us. You don't need to be telling us what to do. There's so much competition in the mobile phone market that this situation will correct itself. Well, isn't there, and won't it?
I think there's always a role for consumer rights, no matter how competitive an industry is. And the truth is, it's not a truly competitive industry in any case. The spectrum that they depend upon is government property, which they lease. There's really only four major players who have the tens of billions of dollars required to be in this market in the first place. We're not talking about the vodka market. We're not talking about blue jeans. We're talking about a government-supervised spectrum-based oligopoly, which is doing things that are not good for consumers. And I think, you know, to say, well, we've got competition, forget about it, is just not an answer to the things we've identified in this study.
But you've also said that comprehensive legislation should only be used as a last resort. So what do you recommend in the short term?
The most important power is consumer pressure. The industry likes to say everything's competitive, everything's fine. You know, they love to keep things as they are. They like the current model. The only thing that pushes them, besides government, is consumer knowledge, consumer pressure. And if people get more and want more of their cell phones, they will eventually get more. That's the most powerful force out here, is the force of the educated consumer.
Tim, thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure.
Tim Wu is a professor at Columbia Law School. We'll link to his paper, Wireless Net Neutrality, from our site on themedia.org. So we just heard Tim say that phone developers have told him, off the record, that they're hamstrung by wireless carriers who shun certain kinds of upgrades. So I put it to Chris Gutman-McCabe, the Vice President of Regulatory Affairs for CTIA, the Wireless Association.
You know, I haven't seen any of those statements on the record. We haven't seen any complaints like that. But what I would say is that we have an industry where there are constantly new carriers entering the market. So in addition to the four large carriers, we just had three other carriers spend several billion dollars to enter a market that is competitive. We just saw a new handset manufacturer, Apple, move into this space. So I would challenge, you know, you or your audience to find an industry that is more competitive, particularly in the telecommunications space, than what we have here in the wireless industry.
But why do we have to pay extra for text messages or for sending photos? Why aren't our cell phones in a fluid conversation with our computers via Bluetooth?
When it comes to things like text messaging and use of pictures, carriers charge different things and they are completely subject to the market. If they are pricing outside of where the market is, then they're going to lose customers.
If competition really were the solution, it would have brought forth the kind of services that people say they want every day.
You know, in a perfect world from a consumer's perspective, you would be able to get every product and service that you want at no cost. But the reality is, in a competitive environment, you let the market dictate.
Chris, if the Carter phone decision regarding landlines made sense, of course, we should be allowed to buy any phone and answering machine we like and plug them into a phone jack, why should any other standard be justified for mobile phones?
I would start from the premise that there isn't a need for regulation unless there's a failure, a market failure. When you had the Carter phone decision, you had a vertically integrated monopoly. So you had one provider providing both the network and the service offerings, but also providing the technology that you use, the phones and the handsets. In this case, you have multiple providers using multiple handset manufacturers within and outside the United States. You have, for all intents and purposes, exactly what government wants. You have an ultra-competitive industry.
Why can't we have call timers?
You know, if that is something that's wanted, then that will happen. Carriers didn't have cameras in their phones 2 or 3 years ago. Now, almost every single phone has it. So, you know, our carriers absolutely listen to the customers. They do surveys. They reach out. And the reason they do is because it's in their best interest to serve their customers.
Customers want call timers. And despite the confusion among the various cost plans, they would be able to use their call timers to compare their usage with their bills. The carriers don't want them on the phones, and so the manufacturers don't provide them.
And I would argue that, as I said, that in a competitive environment, if something is wanted by consumers, someone will provide it, either a niche service provider or one of the large providers. T-Mobile service offerings are different than Verizon's, which are different than Singular's, which are different than, you know, Sprint, Nextel's, and Alltel's. And each of them try to identify where consumer wants and requests and needs are, and they try to fill it. And if they're not, the consumer will move. They'll leave and they'll go to another carrier.
Chris, thank you very much.
Brooke, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Chris Gutman-McCabe is the Vice President of Regulatory Affairs for CTIA, the Wireless Association.
Coming up, stubbing out cigarettes in the movies and Louis Farrakhan's final call.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Humphrey Bogart, Myrna Loy, Clint Eastwood, Edward G. Robinson, Nicole Kidman, Sean Penn. What do all these people have in common? Here's what. They're corruptors of youth. According to a coalition of scientists and public health experts, smoking in the movies, such as these stars have all done, lures young people into the deadly habit and should therefore be discouraged by any means. And they think they have the means, a proposal to give R ratings to films that depict smoking in anything but an utterly negative or demonstrably historical way. Stanton Glantz is a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and a member of the ad hoc coalition called Screen Out. He joins us now. Stan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First, please make the case to me that there is, in fact, a connection between cigarette smoking on screen and how young people behave.
There's about 100 scientific studies of the effect of smoking in the movies on kids. And what all of this evidence says when you put it together is that kids who see a lot of smoking in the movies are about 3 times more likely to actually start smoking than kids that don't see a lot of smoking in the movies. This is what epidemiologists call a dose-response relationship. It's pretty much the more smoking in the movies kids see, the more likely they are to smoke. And you can estimate that about 390,000 kids a year start smoking because of the movies. That's probably the largest single effect promoting smoking among kids today.
And your group is suggesting a 4-part solution.
One is that new movies with smoking in them get an R rating. We think that the simple action of treating smoking in the movies the same way that Hollywood treats abusive language would prevent about 200,000 kids a year from starting to smoke. The second thing we'd like to see is an anti-smoking ad shown before any movie or on any DVD with any movie that has smoking in it, because there's evidence that that ad actually tends to neutralize the pro-smoking effect in the movies without affecting whether or not kids would recommend the movie to their friends. The third thing is an end to all brand identification. There's really no need for it. I mean, one of the directors that I've talked to said that there's actually a person who sits next to him when they're making a film who's in charge of clearances, and he's told not to put any branded merchandise in the film without either a release or a product placement deal. Cigarettes are the only thing where the insurance companies don't require either a release or a product placement deal. And the tobacco companies get out there and they're just shocked, shocked that their brands are being displayed in these movies so prominently. And Philip Morris is now even running ads in the trade press urging Hollywood not to display its brands. But if Philip Morris was serious about keeping their products out of the movies, they would just sue a couple of producers for trademark infringement. The fourth thing we're asking for is what I call a certification of no payoffs. You know how at the end of the movies, when they have an animal in the movie, they have a certification that no animals were harmed in the making of the film? Well, we'd like a certification that nobody got paid off for putting smoking in that movie.
You have provided for a couple of exceptions to the list of rules. One would be for a film which is portraying a historical figure, you know, known to smoke heavily, like Edward R. Murrow in Good Night and Good Luck, or maybe Winston Churchill. Another, in the spirit of the old Hays Code, which allowed you to show someone committing homicide as long as he got his comeuppance in the end, allows you to show smoking if it also shows the negative health effects.
Yes. The reason that we included those two exceptions was, frankly, I got tired of hearing about Winston Churchill's cigar. And the fact is that there are very, very few movies, especially the kind of movies that we're concerned about that are mass marketed to teenagers, where, you know, Winston Churchill stomping around chomping a cigar was a big issue. The exception for actual portrayal of the negative effects of smoking was put in there for similar reasons. We heard objections out of Hollywood. Oh, what if we wanted to make a movie showing, you know, that smoking is horrible and kills people, and that would deprive us of the opportunity to educate kids? So we said, okay. So these couple of exceptions that we've allowed were really put in there to just get rid of a couple of fallacious arguments that were being used against us.
There are all sorts of unhealthy behaviors depicted in PG-rated movies, from eating pizza to jumping out of windows onto awnings to fistfights to car chases. I mean, shall we have movies rated R for reckless driving?
Well, the thing which makes tobacco use different from these other things that you're talking about is we have this tremendous science base. And in those other areas that you're talking about, we just don't have scientific evidence that car chases are causing 400,000 kids a year to go out and drive recklessly and get killed eventually.
What's the reaction been from Hollywood?
For the first couple of years, we were completely ignored by Hollywood, and then they were mad and saying all kinds of mean things about us. But there's been a couple areas where there's been some meaningful progress. The Weinstein brothers have now started putting anti-smoking ads on their DVDs. That's something that the Motion Picture Association told me years ago hell would freeze over before that happened. Theaters are now willing to allow state and city health programs to run anti-smoking ads in theaters before movies with smoking in them. That's something else the Motion Picture Association had told me would never happen.
There's one more constituency I'm interested in, whether you've gotten any feedback from them. And I refer, of course, to actors. It'll ruin them. I mean, there is so much business that an actor does with a cigarette. It's such a good visual shorthand for, you know, anxiety or seduction. Plus, it, you know, just gives them something to do with their hands. Have any of them weighed in on this?
You know, it's very interesting. There's just been absolute silence out of Hollywood on this. A couple of them, like Sean Penn, have very aggressively been opposing what we've been doing, claiming that it's somehow tantamount to putting duct tape over their mouths. There are actors who won't smoke. There are actors who have been, you know, quietly trying to do the right thing here. But this whole argument that, you know, smoking is a way to be edgy or sexy or express rebellion are really showing that these actors are brainwashed by cigarette advertising. Because there's nothing sexy about inhaling 6,000 toxic chemicals into your lungs or polluting the air around you. Those are really visions of smoking which have been created through cigarette marketing.
I think if you were having a conversation with a director at this point, he would say, you know what, Dr. Glantz, you handle the public health. I'll do the directing.
We're not saying that the directors don't have the right to put smoking in films if they want to, just like they can use the F word, just like they can show frontal nudity if they want. It's just that when they do that, then they get an R rating.
All right, Stan, I thank you very much.
Thank you for your interest.
Stanton Glantz is a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco.
Last Sunday in Detroit, Louis Farrakhan gave what was billed as his last public speech.
Here is the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan!
He said his time was up, and his final call was for reconciliation.
Brown and black and red against white, or white against brown, black and red. I don't want to see that. I want to see one nation under God. We all can live in peace.
The papers were respectful. Nation of Islam at a crossroad as leader exits, solemnly noted the New York Times on page 1. Farrakhan preaches peace, observed the Washington Post on page 3. It was a far cry from 1994 when Time magazine correspondent Sylvester Monroe suggested a story on Farrakhan. Monroe later said that the editors first proposed the cover line, Ministry of Hate. But he argued that it failed to capture Farrakhan's appeal to many African Americans. They compromised on Ministry of Rage. But Farrakhan wasn't always the Minister of Rage. Once he called himself the Charmer, back when he sang Calypso.
If you want to be happy living a king's life, never make a pretty woman your wife. If you want to be happy living a king's life, never make a pretty woman your wife.
It was as the Charmer in 1955 that he first encountered the Nation of Islam and gave up the music world. He rose through the ranks of the NOI, but left when the son of NOI leader Elijah Muhammad sought to move the faith closer to traditional Islam. In the late 70s, Farrakhan decided to rebuild the Nation of Islam along its original lines, focused on white devils and racial separation. The mainstream press pretty much ignored him. Until, in 1984, presidential candidate Jesse Jackson, during a chat with a black Washington Post reporter, referred to New York City as Haimetown.
Then a certain Jewish group, the Jewish Defense League, which has a minuscule membership, picketed against Jesse Jackson.
Arthur Magida is the author of Prophet of Rage, A Life of Louis Farrakhan and His Nation.
Farrakhan rushed to his defense, saying in a sense, Jews, you harm this brother, it'll be the last brother you ever touch. And there was this volley of harsh words. Farrakhan was called the new Hitler. Farrakhan then said that Hitler was great, wickedly great. Then he called Judaism or certain practitioners of Judaism, followers of, quote, a dirty religion, and it has gone downhill ever since.
Farrakhan said that the Washington Post reporter who quoted Jackson on Haimetown would be punished with death. Salim Muwakkil, Chicago Tribune columnist, senior editor of In These Times, and a former member of the Nation of Islam, has covered Farrakhan for years. He says that Farrakhan found the mainstream media easy to manipulate.
I guess you could say that's Farrakhan's genius. Indeed, the Nation of Islam was classically racist when it called white people devils and said that they essentially were incapable of acting with justice. But he has transformed that rhetoric so that the white devil is no longer white people. It's the attitude of white supremacy. And so Farrakhan has been altering that racist message since his assumption of leadership.
He'd play with the mainstream press, extending his hand across race lines and snatching it back again.
And he's done it by occasionally being outrageous in the press and alternately conciliatory and contrite. He's managed to calibrate his message in a way that maintains his credibility with his hardcore followers and flirts with mainstream respectability, but doesn't quite get it. But I think that's by design.
Farrakhan played the media like a violin, literally. As a child, he trained as a violinist. His first national exposure was as a prodigy on Ted Mack's famous Amateur Hour. But the media paid a lot more attention when he picked up his fiddle in April 1993.
That all started with an invitation for Farrakhan to play Mendelssohn, I believe in North Carolina, with a small orchestra.
Arthur Magida.
When word got out that he was playing Mendelssohn, Mendelssohn was born Jewish. He converted out of Judaism when he was 8, 9, 10 years old. That part, though, was overlooked. It was received as Farrakhan's musical overture towards the Jewish community. That episode, I think, was misinterpreted, and Louis Farrakhan, being a really smart, savvy guy, allowed it to be misinterpreted.
In some ways, I think the media wants him to reform, and they're pulling for him to make this transition.
Salim Mawakil.
Whenever they pull overtly, I think he says something outrageous to chasten them.
Why should we pay taxes for a police department that kills our grandmothers, kills our babies, shoots us down?
I was sort of taken with something Cornel West said the other day. He said there's a little bit of Louis Farrakhan in every African-American.
Erna Smith chairs the journalism department at San Francisco State University.
And I think what he meant by that is that Louis Farrakhan is essentially a African-American man who isn't really beholden to any sort of white power structure, and he can say whatever he wants to about anybody. And I think that there is that sort of vicarious delight that maybe some African-Americans get in what Farrakhan will say because he isn't really limited.
Here's what he said to Mike Wallace on CBS in the mid-90s, when Wallace said that Nigeria was the most corrupt nation on earth.
Has Nigeria dropped an atomic bomb and killed people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Have they killed off millions of Native Americans? How dare you put yourself in that position as a moral judge? I think you should keep quiet.
Erna Smith says there are two things to remember about Farrakhan.
First of all, the sort of demonization of him in mainstream media as America's bigot-in-chief actually did make him more popular, and he seemed to understand that. And then there was this image of him that he put forth himself in his newspaper, The Final Call, which is essentially the penny press of the ghetto. You could go in any inner-city black neighborhood in this country and find one of these young men out the street selling this paper. And in that, what we got was this image of this man who really loved his people, who was going to stand up for his people against the white people, and that was the only person that really, truly could speak a certain sort of truth to particularly an urban, underclass African-American audience. You know, pull yourself up. Don't look for a handout. Believe in God. Take care of your children.
In October 1995, Farrakhan gathered hundreds of thousands of black men on the Washington Mall for what he called the Million Man March. The media were impressed with his emphasis on family, clean living, self-reliance. They missed his other message, that assimilation would not lead to fulfillment.
So you will see, you know, middle class, upper middle class, young African Americans going to the Million Man March. What was that but an expression of their longing for a sense of community that, in a sense, assimilation had taken them from? Since that longing, since that sense of spiritual isolation continues, I think there will be a need for a voice like his. And so I think we'll probably see this theme again. Who it will be, I don't know.
If the media missed that theme, what did they get from the Farrakhan story? I asked Arthur Magida.
What did the media get out of it? The media got great covers. Oh, look, there's a black man being angry. Isn't that scary? Well, I think it's incumbent upon the media to always examine why any man is angry or why any woman is angry. There was such a great tendency with Farrakhan to reduce him to this cardboard figure. Black man is railing at white America. Look out.
Now, you're Jewish, right?
Yes.
You spent a lot of time with Farrakhan. Did you like him?
I was fascinated, intrigued, repelled, disturbed by Louis Farrakhan. I was infuriated by his rhetoric, and yet he can be perfectly charming.
And, of course, his name way back when he sang Calypso?
It was the charmer. And it's that charm that he was born with that, to an extraordinary degree, has carried him to where he is today.
It was charm of a kind that won over the media last Sunday. His condemnation of the Bush administration's unpopular war was recorded without comment. His calls for reconciliation were well received. Hardly anyone noticed that among the books he recommended at the end of his speech was one that claims the Jews were behind the slave trade.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Peter Garner and Christopher Worth. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.